You are listening to a recording made available by the Friends of Israel Gospel Ministry Incorporated as a service to God's people. This is message number 5 of 12 on the Book of Daniel by Dr. Reynold Showers. This message is entitled, God's Sovereign Rule Over Gentile Defenses.
In Daniel chapters 2 through 7, God demonstrates his sovereign rule over different aspects of Gentile life. Today when we come to Daniel chapter 5, we have God's sovereign rule over Gentile defenses demonstrated. God's sovereign rule over Gentile defenses demonstrated. Let me give just some very brief historical background that will set the stage for the events that are recorded for us in this particular chapter. King Nebuchadnezzar, who has played such a significant role thus far in the book of Daniel, died in the year 562 BC. After three other men had succeeded Nebuchadnezzar to the throne, in the year 556 B.C., there was a fourth man by the name of Nabonidus who became the new king of the Babylonian Empire. And Nabonidus was the king when the events of Daniel chapter 5 transpired. And with that as background, we come to the opening section of Daniel chapter 5, which is contained in verses 1 through 4, and which we could entitle Belshazzar's Feast. And immediately, as we begin with verse 1, we have somewhat of a problem. Let me read verse 1, and then we'll look at the problem. Daniel writes, Belshazzar, the king, held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles, and he was drinking wine in the presence of the 1,000. Now here's the problem with which we are confronted immediately in this chapter. I had just stated a moment ago that Nabonidus was the king of Babylon when the events of chapter 5 transpired. But Daniel says in verse 1 that Belshazzar was the king of Babylon when these events transpired. The big question is, who is Belshazzar? And for many centuries after this book had been written by God's prophet Daniel, that was a great mystery to students of the Word of God. Because up until the 1920s, all of the ancient Babylonian records that had ever been uncovered and deciphered by scholars never mentioned a man by the name of Belshazzar who ruled as king in the land of Babylon. And in light of that total silence concerning this man, skeptics of the Bible began to point the finger at the book of Daniel and say, well, here's another example of the Bible being historically inaccurate. It is not the inspired word of God, as people claim that it is. And some scholars said there never was such a man by the name of Belshazzar who existed. However, in the 1920s, some archaeologists uncovered in the ruins of ancient Babylon more royal inscriptions that had never been seen before by modern scholars. And as they began to decipher those clay tablets, all of a sudden the mystery of who was Belshazzar was unlocked and solved. Because lo and behold, these royal inscriptions referred frequently to a man by the name of Belshazzar. And these inscriptions made it very clear that Belshazzar was the son of King Nabonidus. But there's still another problem. We know who Belshazzar was, but why does Daniel call him king when Nabonidus, the father, was king at this time? Well, thankfully again, these inscriptions that were uncovered during the 1920s solved that part of the mystery as well. They indicated that King Nabonidus, because of some of the decisions and policies that he had made and enforced, became very unpopular with the wise men around the city of Babylon. And these wise men were so upset with Nabonidus that they began to apply pressure upon him, which he did not appreciate. And so by the year 548 B.C., Nabonidus decided that he would like to get away from the capital city of Babylon altogether. He had himself built a home down in the land of Arabia in a community called Tema. And Nabonidus decided to move down to Tema, Arabia. He didn't want, however, to let go of the rule of his kingdom. But you cannot rule a kingdom very well if you are away from the capital city. So Nabonidus decided that he would appoint his son Belshazzar to be co-regent or co-king. And while the father, Nabonidus, left the capital city of Babylon, he had his son Belshazzar remain in the capital city and do much of the administrative work of the empire. And so Belshazzar was indeed a king of Babylon. He was a co-king of Babylon together with his father, Nabonidus. And so this solves the mystery of who was Belshazzar and why does Daniel refer to him as king. Daniel was indeed very accurate in what is recording for us here in Daniel chapter 5. Now, Daniel tells us in these first four verses that Belshazzar threw a great feast for 1,000 of his noblemen. And during the course of the feast, he began to drink wine in the presence of the 1,000. Ancient Babylonian records tell us that in large royal feasts, such as this one, it was the custom for the king to sit upon an elevated platform in the middle of the banquet hall. The king purposely sat on that elevated platform so that he would be above the heads of all the other people assembled there, so that he would be the prominent person and everyone could observe the king and what he was doing. Many scholars are convinced that at the end of verse 1, beginning of verse 2, where Daniel says that Belshazzar was drinking wine in the presence of the 1,000, and that when Belshazzar tasted the wine, many are convinced that what is happening here is this, that after the food had been eaten, that Belshazzar challenged the other men who were assembled in this big banquet hall to a drinking bout, to see who could consume the most liquor and still hold his own without collapsing underneath the table. And obviously, with the king being seated upon an elevated platform, everyone in that large banquet hall could observe the king and notice how much liquor he was consuming and still holding his own. In the language of verse 2, it says, when Belshazzar tasted the wine, this is a polite way of saying when Belshazzar had three sheets in the wind, or in other words, when he was drunk. He got drunk from drinking his alcoholic beverages. And when he got drunk, he began to feel his Cheerios to a certain extent. Notice what he did. He gave orders to bring the gold and silver vessels which Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken out of the temple which was in Jerusalem, in order that the king and his nobles, his wives, and his concubines might drink from them. Just a couple of observations from what we're told in verse 2. Notice Nebuchadnezzar in our English text is called the father of Belshazzar. We just noted a while ago that Nabonidus was the father of Belshazzar. We have to keep in mind again, this part of Daniel is being written in the Aramaic language. And in the Aramaic language, the word which is often translated father is a broad term. It can refer to any male ancestor of an individual, not just your immediate father, but it could be your grandfather or great-grandfather or on back many generations of your male ancestors. Nebuchadnezzar was not the father of Belshazzar. He probably was the grandfather of Belshazzar, but at least one of the male ancestors. You will recall that we saw in our first session in Daniel chapter 1 that when Nebuchadnezzar made his first expedition to the city of Jerusalem in 605 B.C., and then when he learned that his father, Nabopolassar, the king of Babylon, had died, and Nebuchadnezzar decided to rush home to Babylon to claim the throne, he took some of the sacred vessels of Jehovah out of Solomon's temple in Jerusalem captive with him to the land of Babylon. And he placed those sacred vessels of God's temple in the temple of his chief god, Marduk, as a way of humiliating Jehovah, the God of Israel. Here is Belshazzar, years later, calling for the sacred vessels of Jehovah to be brought out of the temple of Marduk over to the banquet hall of the royal palace for him and his cronies to drink more of their alcoholic beverages, get even more drunk from the sacred vessels of God. And actually to use these sacred vessels probably in somewhat of an idolatrous fashion. Now there's a great question that has to be asked here in conjunction with verse 2. Nebuchadnezzar carried captive to the land of Babylon not only the sacred vessels of Jehovah, the God of Israel, but he also carried captive to Babylon the sacred vessels of the gods of other peoples whom he conquered in ancient times. The question that has to be asked here is, why did Belshazzar, on this particular night when he's drunk, decide to specifically call for the sacred vessels of Jehovah? Why didn't he call for the sacred vessels of some other god, of people whom his grandfather had conquered years before? There's a reason why he specifically requested the sacred vessels of Jehovah to be brought there so that he could desecrate those particular vessels of the true and the living God. What is the reason? You will recall that in Daniel chapter 2, when Nebuchadnezzar received that first great dream from God, God through that dream revealed to King Nebuchadnezzar that his kingdom of Babylon would not last forever. Eventually, that kingdom would be conquered by the Medo-Persians. It's an interesting fact of history that 4 months before this feast that Belshazzar was throwing this night, the Medo-Persian troops, having already conquered vast areas of the Babylonian Empire, had come to the capital city of Babylon in which Belshazzar was living. And 4 months before this feast took place on this night, the Medo-Persian army had completely surrounded the capital city of Babylon. In fact, that's why all the other officials of the kingdom were there. As the Medo-Persian armies began sweeping through the areas of the empire where they were ruling, they all fled as the officials of the Babylonian Empire to the capital city of Babylon. Because remember, Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar's grandfather, had built Babylon in such a way that it had the world reputation it could never be conquered by a foreign power. It was the city on the face of the earth that was impregnable. And so the officials of the kingdom decided, that's the place to go. We'll go into the city, we'll hole up in there, and even if the Medo-Persians come and surround us, we don't have to worry. They can't get into us to conquer us or to put us to death or to enslave us. We learn later on in Daniel chapter 5, as Daniel addresses Belshazzar, that Belshazzar was present in the royal palace when Jehovah, the God of Israel, dealt in different ways with his grandfather Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel tells Belshazzar later on in chapter 5, you knew about the way the Most High God dealt with your grandfather Belshazzar. This would mean then that Belshazzar would have known about the revelation that God had given to his grandfather Nebuchadnezzar in the dream in chapter 2. He would have known that it was Jehovah, the God of Israel, who had foretold that the kingdom of Babylon would fall to the Medo-Persians. And so when this is background, get the picture. He knew that it was the God of Israel who said, Babylon will fall to Medo-Persia. And the Medo-Persian armies had been sitting outside the gates of his capital city now for 4 months. He purposely called for the sacred vessels of Jehovah on that night to desecrate those vessels because it was Jehovah who had foretold that Babylon would fall to Medo-Persia. And this was Belshazzar's way, in essence, of thumbing his nose at God and saying, you're the one who said to my grandfather, we would be conquered by Medo-Persia. I am desecrating your vessels to tell you what I think of you and your prophecy. In no way will you be able to make us fall to Medo-Persia. I don't care if they are camped outside my gates. This city is impregnable. Our defenses are absolutely sure. There's no way the Medo-Persians can get in here to take us. There's no way you can fulfill your prophecy of making us fall to Medo-Persia. He is very sure of these great Gentile defenses. But there's a bit of a problem here, because it's one thing to have great defenses that you can hide behind from an enemy, but you've got to live while you're behind those defenses. You've got to eat. And if the enemy has you completely shut off from outside help, you might starve to death after a while. Well, the Babylonians had decided to deal with that problem too. Nebuchadnezzar not only built the defenses of the city to be impregnable, but he had a system set up by which the Babylonians would continually maintain a 20-year supply of food inside that city. Enough food to support the total population of that capital city for 20 consecutive years without any Babylonians having to get out of the city or any people come into the city to bring food. But you also have to have water to drink. Nebuchadnezzar solved that problem as well. When he had the two great walls built around the city to defend it, he had those walls built right over the Euphrates River, so that that great river was running right through the midst of that city, a constant freshwater supply at all times. They didn't have to be concerned of dying of thirst. So Belshazzar, in essence, this night, was taking the attitude, let the Medo-Persians be out there with their great army outside our city. Our defenses are so great they can't get in. They can't starve us out. Let them sit out there and rot for 20 years if they want. We don't have to be concerned. We can hold up for 20 consecutive years. They can't starve us out. They cannot defeat us through lack of water. We are secure. We have got the epitome of Gentile defenses. And so he defames and purposely challenges the true and the living God who had decreed Babylon will fall to Medo-Persia. Well, this brings us to the second section of chapter 5, which is contained in verses 5 through 9, which we could entitle The Handwriting on the Wall. Beginning with verse 5, Daniel tells us that all of a sudden, right in the midst of this debauched, drunken scene in the royal banquet hall of Babylon, up toward the ceiling of one of the walls of that banquet hall, near one of the candelabras where everyone could see, there were very large, unattached fingers of a hand that appeared out of nowhere. No body connected to these fingers at all. And in the foot that would be there against the white plastered wall where the candelabra had been burning for months, these large fingers began to rub off some of the soot as it wrote a message in large letters. And rubbing off the soot, that white plaster would shine through the rubbed off part where the people could see the message very well. Can you imagine what must have happened as some of the people in the drunken revelry happened to look up that direction and saw these large, unattached fingers writing this message, and probably beginning to call out to the king to call his attention to what was going on up there? There must have been terror that struck the hearts and minds of these people who were in this banquet hall on that particular occasion. And Daniel, in verse 6, gives a very graphic description of what effect this had upon King Belshazzar. indicates that the color literally drained from Belshazzar's face. He became so alarmed that his hip joints let loose and his knees began to knock together, and they weren't applauding Belshazzar for being a great man. He was scared to death over the significance of this handwriting on the wall, and you better believe it, he got sober in a hurry. And right away, he lost his emotional cool, and he began to scream out at the top of his voice for the Chaldeans, the wise men, to run in. And they came running in. In response to the king's command, he pointed out the writing on the wall to them, and he demanded that they read the writing and that they interpret it. Tell him and all the people assembled there, what does this writing mean? What is the message that is being conveyed to us? And in verse 7, he promises some outstanding rewards to any of the wise men who can do what he demands. For one thing, he says, any man who can read and interpret this writing, I shall clothe that man with purple clothing. Now, that doesn't mean too much to you and to me today and in our modern 20th century world, but back in those days, that was very significant because purple dye was extremely difficult to produce back in these days, and therefore, purple dyed clothing was extremely expensive, so expensive that only royalty could afford to wear purple clothing. This is why purple clothing became the standard color of kings in ancient times. So what he's saying is, anyone who can read and interpret the writing, I will give that man some of my royal clothing to wear. Secondly, I will place a gold necklace around his neck. Ancient Babylonian records tell us that the only people who were allowed to wear a gold necklace in Babylon were those who were given such a necklace by the king. Since gold was the great metal of Babylon, only the kings and those to whom the kings gave gold necklaces were permitted by law to wear such a necklace in the land of Babylon. And the final reward for the one who could produce, and notice how accurate the Spirit of God is here, the king said, I will give that man authority as the third ruler in the kingdom of Babylon. The first ruler was Nabonidus, the father of Belshazzar. The second ruler was Belshazzar, the son. And Belshazzar is saying, I'll make that man the third ruler, the third one in authority under my father and me in the kingdom of Babylon. But once again, the wise men get their heads together and they look at that writing, and once again they flunk out. They cannot read the writing, nor can they interpret the writing. And when they confess their inability to King Belshazzar, according to verse 9, King Belshazzar grew greatly alarmed. Even more of the color drained from his face. And all the noblemen in that royal banquet hall were greatly perplexed. Evidently, chaos, bedlam, broke out in that banquet hall when the wise men said, we don't have the foggiest notion of the reading of this writing or what it means. We cannot help you. That brings us to the third section of Daniel chapter 5, which is contained in verses 10 through 12, which we could entitle the Queen Mother's Suggestion. The Queen Mother's Suggestion. Verse 10, the queen entered the banquet hall because of the words of the king and his nobles. The queen spoke and said, O king, live forever. Do not let your thoughts alarm you or your face be pale. There is a man in your kingdom
in whom is the Spirit of the holy gods, and in the days of your father, illumination, insight, and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, were found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your father, the king, appointed him chief of the magicians, conjurers, Chaldeans, and diviners. This was because an extraordinary spirit, knowledge, and insight, interpretation of dreams, explanation of enigmas, and solving of difficult problems were found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Let Daniel now be summoned, and he will declare the interpretation.
Many students of the Word of God are convinced that this Queen Mother had been the queen of King Nebuchadnezzar. Probably an elderly woman by this time, and would have been highly respected in the royal court because of her association with the greatest king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar. If this be the case, then she would have been one of the female ancestors of Belshazzar. For some reason, she was not at the banquet that night, but she learned of what was going on in the banquet hall and the chaos that was going on in that room because of the failure of the wise men to read and interpret the writing. She came to the banquet hall and addressed Belshazzar and said, "All right, your wise men have failed, but I remember when your grandfather Nebuchadnezzar was king of Babylon, there was one man in his kingdom who had a unique relationship with one of the gods. And because of that unique relationship, Daniel was able to unlock the mystery of the meaning of dreams and other supernatural phenomena that took place. I suggest, King Belshazzar, that you find this man Daniel and call him in and ask him to read and interpret the writing." And the king takes their suggestion, and so this brings us to the next section of chapter 5, which is contained in verses 13 through 16, which we could entitle Daniel Brought In. Daniel Brought In, verses 13 through 16. King Belshazzar did call for Daniel. Daniel came into that royal banquet hall. And the king spoke to him and asked him, verse 13, "Are you that Daniel who is one of the exiles from Judah, whom my father the king brought from Judah? Now I've heard about you, that a spirit of the gods is in you, and that illumination, insight, and extraordinary wisdom have been found in you. Just now the wise men and the conjurers were brought in before me that they might read this inscription and make its interpretation known to me, but they could not declare the interpretation of the message. But I personally have heard about you, that you are able to give interpretations and solve difficult problems. Now, if you are able to read the inscription and make its interpretation known to me, you will be clothed with purple, wear a necklace of gold around your neck, and you will have authority as the third ruler in the kingdom." Belshazzar follows the Queen Mother's advice. He calls in Daniel. Now, a question could be asked here, why didn't he think of Daniel before? And wasn't Daniel any longer among the wise men when Belshazzar called in the wise men to do this unusual feat for him? We have to keep in mind that there were several changes of administration with the royal throne of Babylon between the time of King Nebuchadnezzar and the time of King Belshazzar. And politics back in these days was very much the same as politics today. When there's a new head ruler, there's usually a dramatic change of administration of all the sub-rulers under the head ruler. And evidently by this time, Daniel had been shoved into the background through different changes of administration and had been forgotten by some of the more recent administrators. And is kind of back in the shadows. But the Queen Mother, who had been living during Nebuchadnezzar's reign, remembered this unique man. And so she suggests that, in essence, Daniel be brought out of mothballs and put back into service again to exercise the unique abilities that he had already demonstrated in previous years. And so here he is. God, in his sovereignty, is bringing this unique man of God back to the fore again into influence with a new administration in the land of Babylon. beginning with verse 17 and going through verse 24, the next section of chapter 5, we have Daniel admonishing King Belshazzar. Interestingly, in verse 17, Daniel, having just been offered these three great rewards by Belshazzar, says to the king, "I'm really not interested in your gifts. You keep them to yourself." Now, this was Daniel's way of indicating to the king that what he was about to do in reading and interpreting the writing, he was not doing in order to get selfish gain for himself. He would read and interpret the writing, whether he got reward or whether he didn't. He could care less about the gain that would come to him by doing what the king was asking. Having set the record straight along those lines at the very outset, Daniel, instead of immediately reading and interpret the writing, begins to lecture King Belshazzar with a history lesson. He goes back and he begins to recount all the different ways that Jehovah, the God of Israel, had dealt with Belshazzar's grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar, when he was king of Babylon. He reminds Belshazzar of how the Most High God had humbled his grandfather, the great king Nebuchadnezzar. And I could imagine that Belshazzar was just chomping at the bit and so anxious to hear the reading and interpretation of the writing, he probably was saying, "Yes, Daniel, I know all that. You don't have to remind me of it. Please get down to the business that I asked you to do." But Daniel had a purpose for going back and rehearsing the history of God's dealing with this man's grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar. In essence, this was his way of forewarning Belshazzar along these lines. If Jehovah, the God of Israel, had to humble and humiliate such an outstanding great king as your grandfather, Nebuchadnezzar, what do you suppose he's going to do to you, who are not nearly so great as your grandfather was? Belshazzar, God is going to deal with you in a harsh way. But you deserve it after what you've just done here in desecrating the sacred vessels of that God Jehovah. In verses 25 through 28, the next section of chapter 5, we have Daniel reading and interpreting the writing. He reads and interprets the writings. In verse 25, Daniel says, "Now this is the inscription that was written out. Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin." The word Mene literally meant numbered. And Daniel interprets the meaning of that in verse 26. This is the interpretation of the message. Mene, God has numbered your kingdom and put an end to it. In essence, Daniel was saying, Jehovah, the sovereign God of the universe, who rules over the affairs and kingdoms of men, has numbered the days of the Babylonian kingdom. He determined how many days that kingdom is to last. And Belshazzar, I'm telling you from God, the number of Babylon is up. This is the last day of the independence of this great kingdom. And notice, as God wrote the word Mene on the plaster of that wall, he used that word twice. Numbered, numbered. He emphasized it. He gave it twice for the sake of emphasizing the fact, the number of Babylon is up. Babylon will fall. The word tekel literally meant weighed. And so in verse 27, Daniel interprets that, tekel, you have been weighed on the scales and found deficient. He's saying this to Belshazzar. Belshazzar, Jehovah, the true and the living God, has weighed you as a man in the scales to determine your moral worth. And I'm sorry to tell you this, King Belshazzar. You don't measure up. As God has weighed you, He has found you morally deficient. You are no longer fit to serve as a king over any people, let alone the land of Babylon. And the final word, and it's given to us here in two different forms, but it's the same word, verse 25, Upharsin, verse 28, where Daniel interprets that word, he gives a different form of it, Perez. That final word literally meant divided. And so verse 28, Perez, your kingdom has been divided and given over to the Medes and Persians. Now, we saw in one of our previous sessions that the Medo-Persian Empire was a partnership empire made up of two different national groups, the Medes and the Persians, who had been united together under one ruler. Daniel is saying, now that the number of the Babylonian kingdom is up, and it's going to fall, that kingdom will be divided between these two partners of this new great Gentile empire. It will be divided between the Medes and the Persians. This was not a pleasant message for King Belshazzar and for his Babylonian noblemen and the ladies who were there in that royal banquet hall that night. This brings us to the next section of chapter 5, which is contained in verse 29, which we could entitle Daniel Rewarded. Because Daniel had done exactly what King Belshazzar had requested, Belshazzar kept his word that he had given earlier, and he gave to Daniel the three rewards. He clothed him with purple clothing. He put a necklace of gold around his neck, and he issued a proclamation concerning Daniel that now Daniel had authority as the third ruler in the kingdom. Much good that was going to do Daniel. He'd only hold that position for the next several hours because that very night Babylon was going to fall to Medo-Persia. But he did keep his word, and he rewarded Daniel as he had promised. That brings us to the next section, verse 30, which we could entitle King Belshazzar Slain, where Daniel says, that same night, Belshazzar the Chaldean king was slain. Babylon did fall as a city that very night of Belshazzar's feast to the Medo-Persians. Now that really demands a big question. How? How in the world did Medo-Persia bring about the downfall of that city that same night? Its defenses were impregnable, supposedly. There were no battering rams or other instruments of warfare available at that time that could even knock a hole in either one of those massive walls that Nebuchadnezzar had built around the city of Babylon. And as we noted in our last session, it was absolute suicide for any invading troops to try to scale those walls. How were the Medo-Persians able to bring about the downfall of that city? One of the most fascinating things in all of world history took place on this particular night. King Cyrus, the Medo-Persian king, as he and his army engineers studied over the whole situation of Babylon, knew they couldn't get through those walls, nor that they could scale them to conquer the city. So Cyrus ordered his men to come up with some way to get inside that city without knocking holes through the wall or scaling the wall. They noticed that the Euphrates River was running underneath the two walls. And so, on that particular night, having already dug trenches off to the sides of the Euphrates River around the city of Babylon, on that particular night, the Medo-Persian troops diverted the water of the Euphrates River out of its main channel off into the side trenches that the Medo-Persian troops had dug. And as they dammed up the water between its source and between the walls of the city of Babylon, forcing the waters off into the side channels, the level of the river Euphrates running underneath those walls just dropped and dropped and dropped and dropped and dropped until there was no water running underneath those walls. And here were the two big holes underneath those walls. And Cyrus that night commanded his troops to jump down into the empty riverbed and march through the water gates into the city of Babylon. And before the Babylonians knew what was going on, the Medo-Persians were in control of the capital city. And the Persian records tell us that the first troops that got inside the city had been commanded by Cyrus, the Medo-Persian king, to head immediately for the royal palace where King Belshazzar was holding his banquet. And their first command was, get Belshazzar. And the ancient records tell us that the Medo-Persian soldiers who got in there first made a beeline for that royal palace. When they got to the massive big doors entering in to the royal banquet hall, they threw open those doors and they headed directly for Belshazzar, who was on his elevated platform. And when Belshazzar saw those doors fly open and recognized what was happening, the records state he stood up on his platform. He drew his royal sword to try to defend himself, but the Medo-Persian soldiers ran him through and killed him on the spot. And Babylon, the city that had the great reputation it could never be taken by an enemy force, fell in one night's time. The date? It was on the night of October 13th, 539 B.C. The great city of Babylon fell to Medo-Persia. October 13th, 539 B.C. Fascinating thing in conjunction with this, almost 200 years before this particular night, another great prophet of God, the prophet Isaiah, foretold by revelation of God that the city of Babylon would fall in one day's time. Look, if you would, at Isaiah chapter 47, verses 8 and 9. Isaiah chapter 47, verses 8 and 9. The prophet Isaiah lived and prophesied during the 700s B.C. Babylon fell almost 200 years later in 539 B.C. But Isaiah chapter 47, verses 8 and 9, in the context, God talking about the city of Babylon said to her, verse 8, now then hear this, you sensual one, who dwells securely, who says in your heart, I am, and there is no one besides me. I shall not sit as a widow, nor shall I know loss of children. That was Babylon's boast. I'm secure. My women will never lose their husbands or their children to an enemy. But notice what God says to Babylon, verse 9, but these two things shall come on you suddenly in one day. Loss of children and widowhood. They shall come on you in full measure, in spite of your many sorceries, in spite of the great power of your spells. And indeed they did come on one day, October 13th, 539 B.C. Babylon fell to Medo-Persia. Jehovah, the God of Israel, the true and the living God, demonstrated his sovereign rule over Gentile defenses. And again, there is tremendous application for us today. It matters not how great the defenses, how sophisticated and highly developed the weaponry of a nation. If God says it is time for that nation to fall, it will fall, because ultimately it is not the defenses and the weaponry that decide whether a nation stands or falls. Ultimately, it is the sovereign Lord of history, Jehovah, the Most High God, who determines the rising and the falling of nations. Yes, we should have our defenses as a nation, but we are not to put our ultimate trust for our security in those defenses. Babylon's fall teaches us that lesson. Father, again, we bow before you in adoration, in awe, in loving respect because of who you are. The great, the true, the only God. Lord, you reign sovereign over Gentile kingdoms. You reign sovereign over Gentile punishments. You reign sovereign over Gentile rulers. You also reign sovereign over Gentile defenses. And may we who are your people through faith in your Son, Jesus Christ, not put our ultimate trust in the strength of horses, chariots, or their modern-day counterparts of weaponry and defenses. But may we put our trust in Thee, the sovereign King of the universe. In Jesus' name, we ask and thank you for these things. Amen.
A free catalog listing other titles in our cassette library will be sent to you upon request. Simply address your request to the Friends of Israel, Post Office Box 123, West Collingswood, New Jersey, 08107.